Give me an I, give me an O, give me a T. What does that spell? Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this here electronic engineering podcast brought to you by EEJournal.com and hosted by me, Amelia Dalton. Yes, we are talking about all things IoT today, from bringing deep neural network calculations to IoT edge devices with IMEC's new analog inference accelerator, to using Wi-Fi to power our IoT electronics and sensors. So before we bring in Peter DeBacker from IMEC, let's get into that Wi-Fi business with a little news you may have missed. Spin torque oscillators. Addition. So, could we use Wi-Fi signals to power small electronics? Sounds a little crazy, but maybe we can do just that. So, a team of researchers from the National University of Singapore and Japan's Tohoku University found that they could use spin torque oscillators to harvest and convert wireless radio frequencies into energy. They powered an LED wirelessly without the use of a battery, using just Wi-Fi band signals. Professor Yang Hunsu from the National University of Singapore Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, who led this project, says this about these energetic developments. We are surrounded by Wi-Fi signals, but when we are not using them to access the internet, they are inactive, and that is a huge waste. Our latest result is a step towards using readily available 2.4 gigahertz radio waves into a green source of energy, hence reducing the need for batteries to power electronics that we use regularly. In this way, small electric gadgets and sensors can be powered wirelessly by using radio frequency waves as part of the Internet of Things. So, why haven't we been doing this all along? Well, two things: spatial and low frequency limitations. So, spin torque oscillators generate microwaves, and that would be perfect for wireless communication designs. But until now, any kind of real-life applications have been limited by their broad line width and their low output power. So synchronization is key to these type of oscillators. Now, if we set them up in a short-range magnetic coupling scheme, well, that has spatial issues to be dealt with. If we synchronize them in a long-range scheme, then, well, the output isn't great and also requires a dedicated current source for each oscillator, which, as you can imagine, complicates things even more. So, this team has come up with a plan to overcome both of these issues, the low frequency and the spatial problems, by connecting 8 of these spin torque oscillators in series. Now, with this kind of setup, this team was able to light up a 1.6 volt LED by converting those 2.4 gigahertz radio waves that Wi-Fi uses, and then converting those into a direct voltage signal, which was then transmitted to a capacitor. And get this, when that capacitor was charged for only 5 seconds, this team was also able to light up that same LED for 1 minute, even after the wireless power was shut off. Wow. So another interesting aspect of this study is how electronic topology plays an important role in the setup of these spin torque oscillators. When these oscillators were designed in a parallel configuration, they performed better for wireless transmission because of a better time domain stability, spectral noise behavior, and control over impedance mismatch. But when they were placed in a serial configuration, they were better for energy harvesting. Huh. So what's next? Well, leaning in on this energy harvesting aspect, This team is looking to increase the number of spin torque oscillators in that array, and they are also looking to test this ability for other wirelessly charging uses, like small electronics and sensors. And even further than that, this team also hopes to work with industry partners to explore the development of on-chip spin torque oscillators for self-sustained smart systems, which can open up huge possibilities for wireless charging and wireless signal detection systems. So, if you want even more information about this super cool new study, I've included a link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com. All right, it's time to bring in Peter DeBacker from IMEC and talk all about deep neural network calculations for IoT edge devices. Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're talking about bringing deep neural network calculations to IoT edge devices today. But Peter, before we get started, can you bring this into focus a bit? What are the biggest challenges we're facing in this realm today? And the von Neumann bottleneck comes into play here, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think the biggest challenge is that when people develop neural networks, typically they run it on a big GPU or even a cluster of GPUs in the clouds. And so you have a massive amount of compute and memory there available. But the challenge, of course, is you want to run those applications on your mobile phones, possibly in wearables like smartwatches, or maybe in security cameras or smoke alarms that also want to detect if maybe there's sounds like people breaking into the house. And that means you need to do a lot of that kind of artificial intelligence processing in a device, which normally only has a small microcontroller. So you have tiny footprint in terms of available memory, a tiny footprint in terms of how much compute you have available, because often those devices are battery powered. So the challenge is, how do you fit this humongous networks that people sometimes make to enable all kinds of cool applications, how do you fit those in small battery powered devices? And typically when those networks are huge, there's two components to that. One is they have a lot of parameters, up to millions, billions, even trillions, when you're talking about natural language processing on the most extreme end of the spectrum. And typically what the von Neumann bottleneck is about is that before you can do any operations on data, you will need to get them from the memory, read them out, then do the computations, and then store back the results or the intermediate results and fetch the next ones, et cetera, et cetera. So that goes back and forth, and you create a bottleneck because there's a bandwidth limitation on the speed you get to accessing the memory. And if that becomes the bottleneck, your whole system gets slowed down by that. And that's especially true in smaller battery powered devices, because a high bandwidth interconnect to the memory takes also a lot of energy, a lot of area. So that's what we're trying to tackle. How can we think of a different way of organizing the way we store and compute for neural networks in such a way that we get much more energy efficient solutions to run neural networks?
Okay, so can we dig into the details of your new analog inference accelerator and talk specifically about the architecture of this new IC?
So what we do in ANIA, as we call it, is we have created a system where instead of having the network weights stored in an external memory or in a memory somewhere, and we do the computation in another part of the chip, we're actually doing the computations in memory. So what we've done is we've stored the weights in this SRAM-based memory. And instead of just reading out the weights, what we're actually doing is we're applying a vector of inputs to the memory. And in a normal memory, you would just read out a single line of the memory and it gives you back whatever word you have stored there. In our case, we apply a vector to the full memory. And in every column of the memory, whatever is stored in there, the input vector that we apply will be multiplied with every value that's stored in the memory. And when we read out the memory, we don't read out the individual weights that are stored. Rather, we read out the sum of products that is required to run a convolutional filter or a fully connected layer in a neural network, because the core operation, 99% of all the operations in most of those neural networks, are simply matrix vector products. So that's what we do. We store the matrix in the memory and we apply a vector at the input. Instead of an address, we apply a vector. And what we read out is the result is again a vector of that matrix vector product. And that way we can, in a massively parallel fashion, actually compute a lot of computations at once without the need for fetching first the weights and then doing the computations on it. So that allows you to get a much higher level of parallelism. So that's good for throughput because we're not bottlenecked by the interface to the memory. And at the same time, what we're doing in order to do that in memory, of course, a memory cell is, you want it to be as compact and as small as possible. Inside the memory, you're operating in the analog domain. So that's why it's an analog inference accelerator. So that means at the input of our memory, we have digital signals, which are converted from digital values to analog values. In our case, that's pulse width modulated pulses, which are applied to every cell in the memory. Inside every memory cell, a multiplication happens, which will selectively, depending on the outcome of the multiplication, discharge part of the line that runs across the memory. And at the output of the memory, we actually sense with an analog to digital converter how much those lines have discharged. And so that the amount of discharge is proportional to the sum of products that we need to calculate. So that's how we actually have a kind of mixed signal solution where inside the memory, everything happens in an analog fashion. Outside the memory, it looks like a digital processing block because there's digital inputs going in and coming out, which makes it easier to integrate into bigger systems.
Now, you guys have been working closely with GlobalFoundries on this project. Can you explain the role that GlobalFoundries is playing in the development of this new chip?
Yeah, so GlobalFoundries collaborates with IMEC on many different topics, and the chip we're talking about today is part of our research program that as a whole has a broader scope to enable extremely energy efficient neural network acceleration, leveraging mostly compute and memory like what we're doing here, but that's broader than just SRAM-based compute like this chip. We're also looking at various kinds of emerging memories can be used, for example, magnetic memories or resistive memories to do similar things. And so our collaboration with GF is really doing the research to help them identify, one, does this kind of concept really work of doing computer memory in these fashions? Secondly, what are the best possible solutions there? You could do SRAM, you could do also other kinds of devices. So it's kind of feeding into their R&D pipeline. So with that research program, we're collaborating with GF. So that joint interest was there. Can we actually, before we maybe develop all kinds of crazy new devices to make this work, can we actually show in a real life demonstrator that the concept works, right? And SRAM is, of course, there's no real technology development needed. It's there. It's available in the 22 nanometer FDX process from GlobalFoundries. So jointly, we've created that, and then GlobalFoundries provided the PDKs to us in order to do the design and helped us getting the design taped out and back to measure. And that's how we collaborated with GF, and they're, of course, very, very happy with all the learning, and we're behind the scenes. Of course, I cannot say much more details, but of course, we're still collaborating with them and with other players as well to further optimize this kind of technology.
Okay. So, Peter, what kind of applications do you see this AI chip playing in an important role for?
Let me first say where it's not going to play an important role. So it's inference only, right? So it's not geared at training. So part of the downsides of this way of doing computation is that the precision is limited. You cannot easily implement the equivalent of floating point arithmetic in a memory fashion like this. And for training, you need very high precision to train neural networks. So we're not positioning this to compete, for example, with the GPUs that people are using to train their neural networks. This is focused at inference. And then especially in those cases of inference where you have a need for extreme energy efficiency, because we get more than 1,000 teraoperations per second per watt out of this multiplication if we do it in memory. So that's a very, very energy efficient number. If you look at what digital is happening, it's about an order of magnitude or more, even better than most of the other solutions in terms of energy efficiency. So we see this for where you want to do inference in a situation where you're constrained in power. And that might be because you want to do something in a battery-powered operation, but it could also be, for example, I know there's applications in automotive, everything which is close to the sensors, you're very limited in the amount of power you can spend there because you cannot put active cooling anywhere, right? So that devices cannot be heated up too much to locally manage the power. So this is also for those kind of places where you want to have in a small volume where you cannot spend a lot of power, want to do a lot of data processing, possibly close to the sensor, right? I think that's where this could be a strong solution. Imagine, for example, if you have a video doorbell where you want to detect multiple people's faces, whether there's a delivery guy at your door or maybe somebody acting a bit suspicious around your front door, you want to be able to detect that with neural neural networks, but at the same time, you don't want necessarily to send all that data to a big server to do all the compute. So you want to do that locally in a small device, right? It still needs to fit somewhere near your door. And you also don't want to have a big cooling fin and ventilator there to cool it. So that's also one of those kind of power constraint scenarios where you could use this.
So, Peter, you recently wrote a paper about this for the 2021 IEEE CICC. So tell me about that paper a bit as well.
The paper actually describes in more detail what the architecture looks like, how we designed that SRAM cell, because it's not a standard SRAM cell. Storage element is not one that automatically also performs the multiplication in memory. So it documents also what that compute cell inside the memory looks like, how we operate the array, and then, of course, also a lot more measurement data of how it performs. And that includes a bit of data on when we run a kind of Cypher 10, which is an image classification benchmark to recognize 10 different classes of images, how we run that on the chip and the kind of accuracy and performance we get there. One thing I might be able to add also is that the network we've used for that is relatively small compared to the size of our array. So we can store 500,000 weights in that array. And if the array is operated in full, we can do a 500,000 of multiply and accumulates in a single compute cycle. So we can fit even bigger applications than what was included in the paper as well.
Fantastic. All right, Peter, it is time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, since you haven't been on my show before, we're going to give you the COVID special. So we've been kind of locked down, it seems like, forever these days. And a lot of times we can't get our favorite foods. So, Peter,
Yes. If
you could have one meal right now, it doesn't matter if you need a passport to get there, the restaurant is closed, it's on the other side of the world, what would you have?
Oh, I would go, it doesn't matter where exactly, but I would want to be in Italy somewhere on a terrace having a nice red wine and a good pasta made by a real Italian chef.
That sounds absolutely amazing, Peter. Awesome. Well, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for joining me.
No problem. You're welcome. It was fun. Thank you.
Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, sure, I dig it. You can follow me or us on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by yours truly. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on that platform of your choice. Also, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, or heck, you just want to chat, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of May 28th, 2021, I'm Amelia Dalton. You've been fried.